The governor's plan for a DPS takeover of Austin police. How would that work exactly? One of the architects of the idea talks about it today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. The politics of policing is not just Austin in the spotlight. The Dallas police chief facing calls for her removal after protests this summer over police brutality. We'll have the latest. Back to school day for many statewide, many first-time teachers and students eager to go bilingual. The border wall on a pre-election day fast track and fighting the scourge of mosquitoes with more mosquitoes? Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this Tuesday, the 8th of September. I'm David Brown. Listeners may recall last week Governor Abbott tweeting he's considering a proposal to put the Department of Public Safety in charge of Austin police. This after Austin City Council voted to cut $150 million from the police department's budget, shifting funds to other social services. We can't let Austin's defunding and disrespect for law enforcement endanger the public and invite chaos like in Portland and Seattle, the governor tweeted. This idea has been raising eyebrows across Texas over the weekend, but Governor Abbott didn't come up with it, apparently. Former Texas House Representative Terry Keel is a former Travis County sheriff, and he's also one of the people behind the proposal Governor Abbott's weighing. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me, David.
When did you come up with this plan, and could you tell us a little bit more about it?
Public safety is not solely an issue for Austinites in the capital city, but it's really something everybody in the state has a stake in. And I looked at what was going on in the middle of Austin, where there's relatively no crime in the 50-square-block area where DPS has control, and then look at the rest of the city where we've just had an explosion of homelessness and a related crime to that, and a spike in homicides and robberies, and I thought, there's got to be a better way to do this.
Would the state legislature have to pass a rule for this? Is this constitutional under the Texas Constitution?
Yes, the legislature has the power under the Texas Constitution to determine what cities will and will not do and has the power to alter their charters. There's procedural requirements. You'd need to make it a general law and not a special or local bill. But the legislature could come in and say, we're going to consolidate the Austin Police Department with the Department of Public Safety. And instead of the chief of the Austin Police Department answering to a city manager, he'll answer to the director of the Department of Public Safety. And instead of the Austin Police Department's budget being set by the Austin City Council, it'll be set by the Public Safety Commission of the Department of Public Safety.
Now, just to be clear, you're suggesting that the legislature can't target Austin. It would have to be a general law. How would you frame that?
Well, there's a way to do that, and it is typically done in the legislature by what's called a bracket. But in this case, the city of Austin, by triggering the governor to deploy statewide resources to supplement public safety in the capital city, the Austin City Council actually handed the legislature the procedural prerequisites to enact the proposal because it's a statewide issue, considering that statewide DPS resources are being used right now to supplement Austin's public safety.
There are people like Austin City Council members who say that this is a lot of political posturing in an election year, and it appears to align the Texas governor with President Trump's law enforcement message. How serious is this? I mean, you're no longer a representative, so you couldn't actually do a formal proposal on the floor, but is there anybody who's actually formally proposing this?
Well, there are members who have turned in drafting requests to the Legislative Council on this already. I'm not at liberty to tell who they are, and traditionally that's private until they get the bill back and they announce what they're going to do. The governor has come out and stated that he's going to consider this. When the governor came out with that tweet last week, this just went viral. I think there's a lot of momentum for it here in Austin in particular because the city council has cut right up front $20 million from the Austin Police Department, and now we've lost a bunch of specialized units like community operations and park police, lake patrol, the organized crime unit. We've lost three cadet classes, including the most diverse cadet class they've ever had. Community policing has taken a hit. So everything that the city council preaches they're for has been jeopardized by what they've done.
As we've heard, a lot of these cuts are being reallocated to social services like food insecurity, violence prevention, homelessness services. Wouldn't investing more in those services also help reduce crime?
You're speaking of about a $130 million that they put in what they called a transitional fund to determine what would be moved out of APD control in order to what they call reimagine or deconstruct the police department and move things under civilian control. All of that is a disaster. They're going to move victim services out of the police department. It's insane, and it's inefficient, and it's going to hurt the operation of the police on a daily basis.
Let me ask you just a personal question from your experience in law enforcement. How would you feel if you were an Austin police officer and you're sort of having to answer to the DPS?
I would feel a lot better than answering to the city manager and to the city council, because the city council here has politicized law enforcement at the local level, and it has dispirited law enforcement here. The police officers here have very low morale. They were chronically underfunded for several years here recently, and now the cadet classes have been canceled. It's jeopardized their pension, and they are having to go into a mode of shifting all their resources to reactive law enforcement instead of proactive. So all these specialized units that get taken away, they're shifting those officers to patrol just to fill the gaps in order to be able to answer calls. So it's been terrible for the frontline police officers in Austin.
Terry Keel is a former Travis County sheriff and a former Republican Texas state lawmaker, and one of the people behind a proposal Governor Greg Abbott's been talking about, which would initially allow the state to take over Austin's police department. Mr. Keel, thanks again for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Yes, thank you for having me aboard. I appreciate it.
With policing in the political spotlight, Dallas Police Chief Renee Hall has been under fire. She's been criticized for how her department has handled this summer's protests against police brutality. Many activists are demanding her removal, and some city council members are questioning her leadership more broadly. KERA's Alejandra Martinez reports.
Kwana Scott was pulled over for an expired car registration back in 2018.
And I was searched, I cooperated, and upon the pat-down, which was done by a male officer, he fondled my breasts, and I freaked out.
The incident and a previous arrest has fueled Scott's fear of the police.
People should feel comforted by the presence of people who are supposed to protect them, and they should not feel scared, because people are scared.
Scott, who's 27, grew up in Dallas. And when Renee Hall was hired as chief of the Dallas Police Department in 2017, Scott felt a sense of hope seeing a Black woman in a position of power. But as time went on, that feeling changed.
Renee Hall has done nothing but maintain the status quo. You would think because herself as a person of color, that would make a difference. Herself as a marginalized gender, that would make a difference. But at the end of the day, the priority goes to law enforcement.
Scott joined the Dallas Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression last year. She says Chief Hall has done nothing to help her people. She is not the only person critical of the chief.
Why did we not see the pictures of the people who weren't even a part of the protest, who were innocent bystanders, who lost their eye walking by from rubber bullets?
That's Dallas City Council member Adam Bazaldua. He's talking about the recent DPD report that details the department's response during the first 4 days of protests in the city. These protests followed the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Bazaldua and other council members have expressed their frustration with Chief Hall and the police department.
I think that she has great intentions and is a great person, but I believe that she puts too much importance in the political aspect of her job.
Bazaldua says there's a lack of leadership in the department and is not sure the chief can deliver.
If we're going to be looking towards progressive reform and aggressive change, it's going to require a leader that's going to kind of go against the fray, stand up when others aren't willing to. And I don't know what it's going to take to start to see that here in Dallas.
Council members do not have the power to fire the chief of police. City manager T.C. Broadnecks does, and he supports her.
These are tremendously difficult times, not just for Chief Hall, I think for the entirety of the police department.
Broadnecks talked with KERA in June.
I think these times require us to think differently and to do better. And I know the chief is committed to that. I'm committed to working with her to find ways to ensure that DPD can do better related to how we police.
This commitment comes as the city is hammering out a budget. As activists call for defunding and reforms, police officers are feeling immense pressure. That's according to Terrence Hopkins, president of the Black Police Association of Dallas.
If I'm sitting up here looking at the newspaper every day and it speaks negatively of the Dallas Police Department, who's controlling my morale now?
Hopkins says criticism from city council members that zeroes in on the chief is unfair. He thinks they should focus on helping officers on the ground.
Police work is done from the bottom up, not the top down. Boots on the ground, get out there and do this job every single day.
Chief Hall was not available to talk for this story, according to the police department. She did speak to KERA in 2017, right before she moved to Dallas to take over as chief.
So I think what we have to do, and what I've seen that works, is that law enforcement has to be the mediator, and we have to be the lead in bringing the right people to the table to address those concerns.
Which is something community activists don't think she's done. Sarah McCoria is the co-founder of Mothers Against Police Brutality. She supports police defunding and says she's lost faith in the department. One of the big reasons, a lack of transparency.
If that does not re-emphasize the need to deprioritize, defund the police and fund the community, I don't know what will.
McCoria has been critical of the department and the chief, but says it's not fair to lay all of the blame on one person.
You can focus on the individual, the chief, and fire the chief and not change the system and the structure. But the issue is the system and the structure, not just the individual police officer. Police chief.
McCoria says throwing money at the police department has failed to keep Dallas neighborhoods safe. She hopes the city invests police dollars into community support programs instead, and hopes Dallas has the courage to make structural changes to the police force. I'm Alejandra Martinez in Dallas.
Monitoring social media, social media editor Wells Dunbar. Hi, Wells.
Hi, David. We're hearing from folks about the topic at the top of the show, an election year proposal from Texas Republicans to take over Austin police. Here's one tweet from Jet Bakes. He writes, I can't imagine how much worse police accountability and instances of police misconduct would get if Austin police weren't under the jurisdiction of the city of Austin and its residents. It's scary, he says. In other news, it's the first day of school, and Houston reporter Lauren Eisensee notes reports of websites crashing and other technical issues. I'd love to hear from the folks out there about what their first day back is like.
Amen to that. You know how to find us. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, and he's going to be joining us again in 35 minutes with many more of your comments. So keep it here. The Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Today, many Texas children are going back to school. It's also a big first day for brand new teachers, too, even if their classroom is online. Houston Public Media's Laura Eisensee takes a look at how some first-year teachers are anxious to connect with their students in bilingual education.
First grade teacher Jocelyn Ramos knew she wanted to decorate her very own classroom with a warm rainbow theme. She just never expected it'd be at her house. She sent me a quick video tour of her setup.
This is probably my favorite part because it just feels welcoming. And it's a welcome bulletin board. It says bienvenidos.
Ramos has been getting ready to meet her class of 18 first graders at Moreno Elementary online.
Bienvenidos estudiantes al primer día de clases. Mi nombre es Miss Ramos y yo seré tu maestra este año escolar.
She says she always wanted to be a teacher. Growing up, Ramos loved tutoring her younger cousins. The new University of Houston grad studied bilingual education because that's how she learned English. On top of her mind, figuring out how to create the same kind of connections she had with her teachers with virtual school.
I think what I want to do is I want to make sure that we can connect and make sure that they feel safe and welcome.
Those relationships are especially important for children learning English. Texas has over 1 million of these students. That's 1 in 5 of all public school kids. Bilingual education expert Hector Bojorque says the best thing teachers can do is give constant feedback to their students and their parents.
A rule I had when I was a teacher, I called every child's parents 3 times with positive notes about their kids before calling about any concern. 3 to 1. It was always my 3 to 1 ratio.
Building a sense of community also weighs on school administrators as they bring on new instructors. It's been challenging since so much of school hiring and training has been remote.
So that's where you have to pull out your principal superpowers, you know.
That's Diana Castillo. She's the principal at Pilgrim Academy in Houston. She's hired 8 new teachers this year for her campus, where most of the 1,100 students are learning English.
Staying in constant communication was something that was extremely important for us, and especially over the summer.
Castillo also paired new teachers with veteran educators. And as school staff stopped by campus to get supplies last week, administrators gave them a big welcome. That support has made one first-year instructor, Diana Chicas, feel like she's got this.
Even if there is something that comes up that I wasn't 100% prepared for, I have the confidence that there will be someone there that can help me get to that 100%.
Still, she says starting her career during COVID feels bittersweet.
So it's like feeling as if something was kind of stolen from me in a way for my first year experience. But also, it's like such a unique experience that it just makes my first year so much more special, if that makes sense.
That does make sense to her fellow first-year teacher, Jocelyn Ramos, at Moreno Elementary in North Houston. Ramos can't wait to get to know her first graders.
I haven't even met them, but I already love them because they're going to be special. And they're going to have a special place in my heart because they're going to be my first class.
And COVID-19 can't take that away. I'm Laura Eisensee in Houston.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a health and safety-focused workers' compensation provider, reminding Texans that the best way to stick together right now is to stay apart. More at texasmutual.com/coronavirus.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The pandemic has taken a toll on the tourism economy everywhere, but it's had a special impact in West Texas. The region's home to Big Bend State Parks, museums, bed and breakfasts, and more. Many of the area's attractions have limited their hours or closed altogether, with major ripple effects for local economies. Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales reports.
The noonday sun in Terlingua, Texas is blindingly hot. Crystal Albright takes me into one of the few shaded areas within eyeshot of this far-flung corner of the Chihuahuan Desert.
And then we're coming up on the boat barn.
Albright is a co-owner of Desert Sports. The company runs guided tours. Bikes and kayaks and canoes are stacked up to the ceiling. She pats her boats as she calls out their names.
This is Sierra. And Sierra is named after one of our guide's dogs. And then there's one that's Rubia. She was a blonde German Shepherd that showed up here one day. And
the boats aren't getting much use these days. Tourism here always slows in the summer. But this March, hotels, motels, and short-term rentals closed for more than a month to everyone but essential workers. And the region's biggest tourist draw, the 800,000-acre Big Bend National Park, closed and then reopened with limited access.
We had been through other closures before. There's been a couple of government shutdowns. We're used to having those challenges thrown at us, but this one was a little different.
By all accounts, Far West Texas was on track to have a banner year. The national park was expected to surpass 500,000 visitors for the first time in its 76-year history. And when tourism is high, the dollars to nearby cities follows.
The visitation went from full steam, 100%, to zero.
Robert Alvarez is the executive director of the local tourism board, Visit Big Bend.
We didn't think it would be to this extent or last this long. And now it's really, really come to be our worst nightmare.
And some of the most important taxes that counties receive, hotel occupancy taxes, have plummeted. Alvarez says in Brewster County, which is home to Big Bend National Park, these taxes dropped in April from $116,000 last year to about $1,000 this year. In the following months, they rose, but were still less than half of what they normally are.
It will be years before we're back to normal, before we were able, like I said, to kind of get back to where we were at the beginning, January 1st, 2020.
Photographer Leslie Villarreal had just set up her own gallery among the boutiques and artsy shops on Marfa's main street, and then the pandemic hit.
I just couldn't survive it. There was no way.
She tried opening with safety measures in place, but says it just didn't work for her. So she called it.
And I wasn't really comfortable with opening because then I'm just saying, hey, it's okay, come visit us. You know, bring the virus here. So I really had these inner battles of, do I keep my business alive? Do I risk getting sick?
Now Villarreal mainly sells her work online. Some of her eye-catching items, coffee mugs and t-shirts with tongue-in-cheek quotes about Marfa, like,
everyone hates their lives here. It sucks pretty good. So yeah, I just take little sentences, worse than it already was, which is my favorite, by the way. That's a new one. Yeah, so it's just poking fun, you know.
Tourists, though, are still coming.
We wanted to do hiking, and I like it out here because I like the isolation, or like an oasis in the middle of nowhere.
You know, we're hoping to see some art and see some of the Marfa staples.
That's Sarah Talamash from New York and Devin Smith from Austin. Though no matter how many people come through, Robert Alvarez with Visit Big Bend says the rest of the year is a wash.
The fall was looking like we're making a small recovery here, but our big events, you know, the chili cook-off, have been canceled.
Back in Terlingua, Crystal Albright says she's getting about one or two customers a day.
We're not encouraging people to come, but if they're going to come, we want them to be healthy and enjoy their time here.
Albright says the company's received two loans so far, which have helped, and she says they're being pretty frugal, so she's cautiously hopeful they can make it through to next spring. I'm Carlos Morales in Marfa.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, dedicated to the fight against cancer through telemedicine, providing patients with the ability to conduct online virtual appointments. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Texas Medical Association, along with more than 30 organizations, is urging Governor Greg Abbott to create a plan to expand health care insurance coverage to more Texans. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports the state's already high uninsured rate has been climbing during the pandemic.
Those organizations represent doctors, nurses, patients, hospitals, clinics, long-term care providers, and insurance companies. They're all asking Abbott to start planning now to enact policies that will expand comprehensive health care coverage to more Texans, particularly low-income working Texans, many of whom are essential workers. The groups say Texas has many options for expanding coverage, including drawing down Medicaid expansion dollars that state leaders have refused to use. The groups point out that conservative states like Indiana, Ohio, and Utah have actually used those funds to design unique health care coverage plans. In just the last 2 months, voters in Oklahoma and Missouri have approved measures to expand Medicaid in their own states.
Ashley Lopez reporting. Texas lawmakers are looking at how to safely resume in-person proceedings amid the coronavirus pandemic. Senator Carol Alvarado of Houston is part of the group working on reopening the Capitol for interim hearings as soon as next month.
You may have members that are in Austin with a plexiglass in between us or sitting far apart from one another and perhaps taking testimony virtual.
But fellow Democrat Senator Sarah Eckhart says it's unwise for lawmakers to return to her Austin district this fall.
I am very concerned that the return of the Texas legislature and the denial by the Texas legislature of the serious health consequences of in-person face-to-face meeting will actually increase the spike among my constituents in Bastrop and Travis counties.
Eckhart and Alvarado spoke today during a Texas Tribune Festival panel. An early season cold front moving through the Texas panhandle is bringing windy and chilly conditions to the area. It might also lead to record low temperatures and snow. Luigi Meccarello is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service.
In the northwest Texas panhandle, temperatures might be cold enough for some rain to mix in with some snow at times. We don't expect any accumulations at this time, as the ground is, from the day before, we had temperatures in the 90s, is quite warm. So at least on the ground level itself, we don't expect snow to stick.
Communities that could see a wintry mix tonight include the small town of Texline. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Department of Agriculture. Because of educators and school nutrition professionals, over 5 million Texas children have daily access to nutritious school meals, many including local products. Learn more at farmfreshfriday.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. If there's one thing that Southeast Texas doesn't need any more of, it's mosquitoes. So you wouldn't think that a plan to release 750 million of them in Harris County would be met with a whole lot of enthusiasm. But it might happen. In late August, a biotech company called Oxitec announced that the Environmental Protection Agency approved its plan to release millions of mosquitoes in the Florida Keys and in Greater Houston, pending approval from local leaders. But these aren't just any mosquitoes. Here to tell us more, Gabriel Hamer. He is an associate professor of entomology at Texas A&M University. Professor Hamer, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
What's the big idea, dropping a whole lot of mosquitoes in Harris County?
Right. So this is one of kind of the new generation of mosquito control. Oxitec's approach is where they have what they consider a self-limiting gene. These males would be mating with wild females, and then the offspring would be, you know, less fit or unable to live as long. And so, you know, ultimately their population should decline.
Let me just back up for just a moment, because people talk about genetically modified mosquitoes. I think that maybe that conjures up images of Jurassic Park sized proportions. I mean, that once you're talking about genetically modifying critters in the ecosystem, that you could unleash, well, a whole Pandora's box. Are there broader ripple effects to the ecosystem that need to be considered here?
So, yeah, there's a lot of thought that goes into this. At least with this initial goal, it's not considered necessarily gene drive. The goal is not to have this genetically modified organism, you know, spread and become prevalent throughout all the mosquitoes in Harris County. That's actually not their intent, but there is a lot of research looking into what would happen in that case. Is there a way to control it and limit the ability of the genetically modified organism to persist in the population? So there's still a lot of kind of unknowns on that topic.
Well, this may be another naive, entomologically speaking, question, and that has to do with what it might mean if you had fewer mosquitoes. I can't think that it would mean anything but, you know, fewer bug bites, but surely these mosquitoes must be part of a larger ecosystem that is required, or no?
So with a lot of these mosquito control approaches, they're often targeting very specific species. In this case, it's targeting Aedes aegypti, which is actually not one of the most common mosquitoes in Harris County. There's a lot of other mosquitoes in Harris County, different species like floodwater salt marsh mosquitoes. Certainly, if you think of the 84-ish mosquitoes in Texas, I would say some of them are definitely important. Some of them are actually pollinators of plants, and they could be important food items for certain other organisms, such as bats. But Aedes aegypti, the ones that now are spread through much of the United States, they're a domesticated mosquito. They typically thrive in the urban environment. And there's actually, for that particular species, there's probably not a lot of ecological services, meaning they aren't playing that important of a role in the ecology or the ecosystem, because they're kind of somewhat man-made. You know, they're the ones that kind of adapted to our urban environment and now thrive in the urban environment. So if we were to eliminate or eradicate Aedes aegypti from, say, Harris County, that it'd be hard to find a negative, a cost of that.
I see. You know, you think about the fact that this isn't an approach that's been approved everywhere. It's only been approved in a couple of places, Key West and Harris County. So how much of a risk are those two places putting themselves at for the benefit of controlling this one species of mosquito?
So they have been conducting these trials in other countries. So there is some precedence for, you know, Oxitec demonstrating some evidence that it could be working in other places. So this isn't a complete, you know, first experiment. And again, if not, you know, an attempt to control using, say, Oxitec, some of these other options, like an adulticide, they're not perfect either. Sometimes there's negative consequences to, you know, killing beneficial insects, for example. So that has to be considered, which is that every approach has pros and cons. I mean, right now, there's no evidence of releases of the Oxitec mosquitoes are causing major problems around the world. So it probably would be unlikely in the United States either.
Gabriel Hamer is an associate professor of entomology at Texas A&M University. Professor Hamer, thanks so much for speaking with us on The Standard.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town. Tours with social distancing at Moody Mansion, Bryan Museum, and Bishop's Palace. More at galveston.com. It's Island Time with safety in mind. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good, like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save the horned lizard from extinction. TCU, lead on.
My name is Katie Podoretsky, and I'm a licensed massage therapist. I have 18 years. My office is a private practice in East Austin. Last fall, I started teaching in-person classes, though, of self-help to relieve head, neck, and jaw pain. I turned that into an online course. So all of that has grown and evolved quickly as COVID has changed many of our businesses. You know, masks they're the new normal, but how you wear them can increase that jaw tension, TMJ disorders, or headaches. So you do want to wear your mask, but you just want to wear it smarter. There are two main types or styles of masks. One are those ear loop masks. They're the ones that commonly most of us can hand make, or the surgical mask kind of thing that just have an elastic strap that goes around the ear. That elastic band can be too tight and it can pull that ear structure forward and into the jaw joint and the disc. And then that irritates those tissues. The other type of mask are those over-the-head mask styles, like the N95s, and those elastic bands can be really tight, and then that is sort of doing the opposite. Instead of pulling the ear forward, it takes the whole jaw, the lower jaw or the mandible, and pulls it back and compresses that into the jaw joint. If you've got a mask that falls down or slides and you start to do this, I call it the scooch, to scooch the mask back up over your nose because your hands are busy doing another project, that's the equivalent of grinding the teeth. So in that case, maybe you're making sure that you have a properly fitting mask. You might want to make sure that it's not too tight around the ears. Another solution would be making sure you're well hydrated. Mouths are now covered up with masks, so we're less likely to take small sips of water throughout the day. When our bodies are dehydrated, that alone can trigger a headache for some of us, and that can make the muscles and the nerves more irritable. So we also have the issue of enunciation, and we are wanting to be heard through at least the equivalent of two layers of cloth, and sometimes from maybe like a 6-foot distance because we want to be polite and safe. And we don't want to sound like Charlie Brown's teacher, wah, 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 wah. So we're going to speak louder, and we are going to enunciate more to be heard. And this is really very fatiguing to these muscles and the joints. I have found one that finally I have sewed for myself, and it is a fire pattern with ear loops, and it's just bunched enough on the sides and has enough space to cover both my nose and wrap under my chin. So I like that one. This is Katie Podoretsky, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
We're collecting stories from Texans about life in a time when we're required to wear masks. Does wearing a mask pose any particular challenges to you? Have you chosen one you think really speaks to your personality? We'd like to hear from you. Reach out on social media or email us, texasstandard@kut.org. Ciara L. Bryant carries a camera everywhere she goes. Her images paint a complex portrait of Bryant's life as a black woman in Dallas. As part of an ongoing series exploring the creativity of black artists in North Texas, KERA's Miguel Perez spoke with Bryant about the power of images.
Miami left its mark on Ciara L. Bryant.
The houses were all these bright colors, and it just made me appreciate little things that were going on in people's homes or like things that they were wearing.
As a kid, she would use her disposable camera to capture her hometown, and the 90s was ripe with inspiration for the young photographer. Lauryn Hill on the cover of Vibe magazine, million dollar music videos from Hype Williams, and on TV. Seeing Brandy shine in the sitcom Moesha was among the many visuals Bryant was taking in.
That was the first time I saw someone that looked like me in this role that had braids and that was falling in love and how important that was.
Now, the multimedia artist uses images to tell her own story.
If I'm shooting or if I'm doing a video or I'm doing an installation, it all comes back down to how am I showing the black body through art in this way.
But her creative energy took a dive this year amid a pandemic and the wave of protests against police violence.
The world was literally on fire. All these people are dying, and it's just like, how can I be in a state of like creativity when I'm so concerned about my neighborhood and my community and myself and my mom?
So instead, she spent months collecting images that spoke to what this moment felt like for her. Protest photos and tearful women in masks and tributes to Breonna Taylor, but also Twitter memes, posters, and triumphant self-portraits.
And it just evolved into these moments of being what is existing and what is living, and how do you show that?
She made an installation using that visual archive that you could see from the windows of the Nasher Sculpture Center.
I'm very vulnerable at all times. Me being vulnerable about my body, my existence, my childhood, lack of childhood, I'm always sharing.
Bryant says black image makers rarely have the agency or space to share their whole story.
The people that are in charge of distributing these images in these moments are the people that failed us.
This year, decision makers in the art world and in media, entertainment, and sports are scrambling to say or do something in light of growing calls for racial justice. In July, for example, Vanity Fair tapped Dario Calmes to shoot the cover. He became the first black photographer to do so since the magazine was founded in 1913.
Wow, you waited till people were making all this noise to be like, oh, maybe we are, you know, kind of not being inclusive. No, you've never taken the time. And even now in these moments, you're not even being inclusive. You're just jumping on a bandwagon.
She says institutions are especially keen to capitalize on black trauma. As part of her practice, Bryant sat through videos of police shootings and 911 calls that have ended up online.
Why are people immortalizing these moments that are like traumatic and detrimental to black people? Why are they, you know, preserved on the internet?
It's opportunities to explore black joy that are in short supply. Bryant says the internet has also opened the door for black artists to more fully express themselves.
We have taken control of our narrative in a very specific way, and we can share as much as we want.
For her latest show at 500X Gallery, Bryant invited 11 artists to do just that. She titled the show Vibrant Thing after the Q-Tip song. Check it out
now. And thinking about like how joyous that song makes me feel even 20 years later, I just want to take the moment in and just enjoy it. Moments where it is a shared experience of joy or a shared experience of recognition.
Vivant is French for living. the very thing Brian wants to capture in all its wonderful, awful, vibrant glory. I'm Miguel Perez in Dallas.
The exhibition, curated by Sierra L. Bryant at 500X Gallery, runs through September 13th. We'll have a link to more at our website, texasstandard.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. With Election Day just 2 months away, the Trump administration is racing to build more wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. The target is 10 miles of wall a week. Many of those projects on the Texas-Mexico border have been met with controversy, including one next to an historic cemetery in the Rio Grande Valley. Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leaños Jr. reports.
Sylvia Ramirez is standing at the entrance of the historic Eli Jackson Cemetery. Some of her relatives are buried here. Inside the cemetery, there are bright flowers laying by headstones that date back to the late 1800s. No more than 20 feet away, heavy machinery is flattening out the land. Ramirez says the machines have cleared out brush and trees that have now left the ground bare.
It is heartbreaking just to know that this horrible symbol of hatred, which is the wall for Trump, is going to be just hovering over our cemeteries, disturbing the peace of our ancestors.
Ramirez says the construction taking place just feet away from here is for the border wall and an enforcement zone. She says it's very hard to watch.
Ultimately, we don't know what's going to happen with the cemeteries themselves. They keep saying that they are not going to build within the cemeteries. It's a language that's used within the law, the 2020 appropriations law. But we have to see it to believe it.
Last year, Ramirez says she was jumping with joy when she and her family heard that this historic cemetery would be protected from border wall construction. Congressman Henry Cuellar added language to an appropriations bill that said there would be no border wall construction within historic cemeteries and other cultural and historic sensitive areas in the region. Just down the street from the Eli Jackson Cemetery is the Jackson Ranch Church and Cemetery. Sylvia's brother, Ramiro, shows me some of the family's tombstones.
My father is here in the middle with my mother and my younger brother, but the two on the side will be myself and my wife, and will be Celia, and it'll be my other sister. So we already have our plots chosen, and we already know where we're going to be.
Ramiro and Sylvia say this land means so much to them, and that it should be preserved because it's home to some hidden history that many people don't know about. It involves their great-great-grandparents.
Nathaniel Jackson and Matilda Hicks, who was born into slavery, came from Alabama in 1857. They were important and significant players in the Underground Railroad to the south, that is to Mexico. So for people who were escaping slavery and were attempting to go into Mexico, they would assist them via a ferry boat.
By the time Nathaniel Jackson and Matilda Hicks arrived here, Mexico had already outlawed slavery, so they'd help others get into Mexico. Ramiro says even though right now the construction of the wall isn't happening within the cemetery, he and his sister still have concerns about the wall's impacts.
And one of the reasons is flooding. The other reason is that we're going to be like a no man's land. We're not going to, the fence is going to cut us off to the rest of the United States.
Ramiro says they're also worried about the type of access they will have to the cemeteries and church. Sylvia says CBP hasn't given them much information about that.
It's beyond me why they would tackle this extremely sensitive area that includes not only these cemeteries and historical church, but also buildings that are essentially places that people live. There's lots of open field going at least east, but they're choosing, for whatever reason,
who put the knife into the ribs right at this particular section. That I don't understand, and that angers me, and I can't get an answer for that.
It's a question Congressman Henry Cuellar has also asked the Department of Homeland Security.
And I said, look, I mean, you can go further up. You don't have to do it right there, but, you know, they're basically said, well, we're just following the law. We're just following the law. But the spirit of the law is that area. I mean, you don't want to have a fence 1 or 2 feet or 1 or 2 yards outside of the, you know, within the whatever the territory might be that we're talking about.
Both Sylvia and her brother Ramiro say this upcoming election means a lot to them. In the meantime, Ramiro is being represented by Earth Justice, who is considering filing an injunction. CBP said in a statement that an environmental monitor will be present every day during construction activities to ensure that construction best management practices are adhered to. The agency also said, quote, it has never been CBP's intent to disturb or relocate cemeteries that may lie within planned barrier alignment. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in FAR.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Social media editor Wells Dunbar with more of the talk of Texas on this Tuesday. Hello, Wells.
Well, we are continuing to hear about that story at the top of the show, that Republican proposal for the state to take over Austin policing. We heard from the architect of that plan at the top of the show, former state lawmaker Terry Keel. We have an email from Dave Thompson. He cites two big issues with some things Keel said, including what he referred to as a spike in homicides. He notes that that lacks the context of Austin's per capita rate compared to other cities, which is indeed pretty low. I believe we had PolitiFact Texas on last week speaking about that. He also notes that you accept the challenge, you accept without challenge, that DPS policing stats for the 50 square blocks of Austin, he's referring to that area of the Capitol complex, I believe, without noting that those 50 square blocks around the Capitol look nothing like the rest of Austin or any other city in the entire state. Mm-hmm. So obviously a controversial issue that folks are continuing to chime in about there. You know what else has big headlines today, news potential? That would be the first day of school in several communities. Including the Houston region, Austin. Lots of parents chiming in with that one, and I could tell you my own tales of woe, David, but I will not. Instead, I'll bring you this comment from our Facebook page from Brad Schoeg. He says, I dropped my kid off at school, and I feel so strange and different. Of course, he may be in the minority there because so many children are doing distance learning. Pat Snow says, thank goodness for all the wonderful teachers keeping our kids safe. All staff wears masks. Too bad all parents don't. And Kayla Salas, she says she's going through day one of distance learning with a first grader, a one-year-old, and trying to work from home. I'm a bit overwhelmed, to say the least. And obviously, I think a lot of folks out there can emphasize with that. Definitely,
yeah, absolutely.
So.
Absolutely, yeah. There are a lot of parents who are having to work from home right now and just keeping up with what kids are doing in the classroom as well. It's not just a job. It's two or three or four jobs. So, yeah, absolutely. It's a very, very busy news day. What else are you seeing out there?
Well, here I'm just scanning the headlines quickly. I like this new story from Vice. The headline here, hundreds of Americans planted Chinese mystery seeds. We did some reporting on this
a while back.
The mysterious packages of seeds arriving at people's doorsteps in their mailboxes unsolicited. Well, the reporter from Vice here filed a public information request with all state departments of agriculture in 50 states. The big takeaway, he writes, is that many Americans planted the seeds. Luckily, I think we're still standing as a nation, but we did hear that not to plant the seeds because there was a lot of question. You know, these things were unlabeled or labeled in Chinese.
Come from
hard
a lot
to
of people hadn't
for
asked for these
folks.
Seeds. That was the odd thing. New York Times reporting that the Senate's going to vote to advance a scaled back stimulus bill. Lawmakers have returned to Washington to battle over virus relief, and that's certainly going to be one of the stories making news in the next several hours. We're out of time for the big broadcast. The news continues at TexasStandard.org, and we hope you'll visit us there. Till tomorrow, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.